Hello and welcome once again to canonblogger.com. You're listening to episode number 64. In this week's episode, I'll be doing my review of the Think Tank Photo Streetwalker. It's a new bag they have debuting for this year in 2009. I will also be taking a look at the value of the backstory, looking at whether or not it can be useful to share the background story, the circumstances behind which the image is captured. And last but not least, I will also take a look at some blog notes, some changes I've made to the blog, and some upcoming changes that will be going into effect both about the blog, the content on the blog, and the podcast and the delivery system. As always, I will round out with some listener questions and a road tip. So be sure to stick around because my review of the Streetwalker is coming up right after this. So, welcome to Canon Blogger's 64th episode. First off this week, I am taking a look at Think Tank Photo's new Streetwalker bag. I wanted to start off by saying thank you to Think Tank Photo for generously donating their basic Streetwalker bag to me for review. They were kind enough to actually make it a donation as well. They said if you'd like to incorporate that into your gear system after you're finished reviewing, please feel free to do so. We always like it when people keep our products. So I wanted to say thank you for that generosity, and also as kind of a caveat emptor, having said that, though, I do also want to note that I will not be hanging on to it. I think that would probably bias my objectivity. So at the end of the show, I'm going to be announcing how you can win this Think Tank Photo Streetwalker bag. So stay tuned to the end of the episode to catch the news on that. So starting right off, I've got the bag right in front of me. I'm going to give you the dimensions on this bag. I've got a ruler right in front of me and the bag itself, and I'm holding it up, and it looks like it measures about 10 inches across, left to right, and then from top to bottom, it goes longer than the length of the ruler, so it goes to probably about 14 inches in height, and it's a pretty sharp-looking bag. It's got your basic black. It's got the Think Tank logo on the front, and there's two front pockets. The top pocket is for things like notepads, pens, papers, maybe gray cards or bounce cards. There's a little slot here for business cards, things like that, a little mesh section. The typical kind of accessory pocket pouch that zippers shut. And then underneath that is another one where you could possibly put a lens hood or something like that, other white cards or possibly batteries if you were so inclined. That also zippers shut. And they've got a nice zippering system. They've got little grips that you can grab onto, and they're not the plastic or metallic ones like you see on a jacket. It's more of a loop type thing that loops through where the zipper goes up, and is much easier to grab onto. And because they're mesh material, you can tie them off on each other so they can't get unzipped if you're so inclined. I thought that was a pretty interesting feature. Another cool feature on the outside of the bag here is on the top. There are two straps that clip together. It's a quick release clip on top, and there is a quick release clip on the bottom, and that allows you to mount a tripod and carry a tripod on the surface of your backpack as it's attached to your body. A very cool feature that I did not have in my Streetwalker bag from Lopro. So, and I think I just bumped the microphone, so apologies for that. And then when you open it up on the inside of the lid, there are two sealable zippers, also with the same mesh material. You can't tie those off, though, because it is just the one. And that's a great place to put things like filters. I've got a circular polarizing filter that sits inside there right now quite loosely, so there's room for bigger filters. That's a 58 millimeter. You could probably hold a 77 millimeter filter in there with no problem. And then looking on the inside, it's just like any other bag where it has the Velcro things that you can take in and out and position as you need inside the bag to accommodate your specific lenses. I was able to fit all of my gear inside this bag, and that includes a teleconverter. I've got a 1.4 teleconverter. It's a Tele Plus Pro from Kenko Tokina. So I've got that teleconverter in there. I've got the kit 18 to 55 lens from Canon. I've got my Sigma 70mm. I've got my Canon 7200L lens. I've also got my 550EX flash in there. And I can also fit the 40D body in there, as well as the 10 to 22mm lens inside this case as well. What I did to make everything fit was I took the 550 out of its own carrying case, and I folded it down into an L, like I'm pointing it forward normally on a camera, and put it inside there so it took up less space. And then what was neat about that is on top of that, I could include my little battery case. It's kind of like a clip, so it holds multiple batteries in clip-type fashion where you can pop new ones out and put old ones away and turn them upside down so you know which ones are fresh, which ones are old. It fits right underneath the flash inside the base of the inside portion of the bag. And like most other bags, it also has a central foam padding that will pretty much go down the center, and you can position that however you want inside there. It was a pretty extensive set of gear for a basic level bag, and it did hold quite a bit. Because it's a 14-inch high bag, it will go lower on your back than the low-pro version of a streetwalker-type bag or a street trekker. I think the low-pro version is called a street trekker, not a streetwalker. So it did hang about 4 inches lower. For a tall guy like myself, I'm 6'1". That actually was very useful when I was wearing the low-pro street trekker. I felt like I was carrying a kiddie knapsack. It almost felt too small for my body type. Even though I didn't have the gear to fill it, so I didn't really need anything bigger, it felt like it was too small for my body. This Think Tank photo, Street Walker series, was because it's taller, it felt more comfortable on my body. Your mileage may vary depending on how tall or short you are, how big you are. You may have a different comfort level for this particular size bag. The outside of the bag has two zippers that go all the way up top, and it also curves downward. So when you get the zippers up to the very top of the bag, once you get them to the top, there's a downward curve to it, and that kind of ties things off nicely. It gives a nice angled view to it, so it's nice and tight up against your body, so it's not hanging out too far. And those two zippers you can also tie off yourself so they don't unzip on you accidentally. Another neat little feature is on the top of the bag, they have a little mesh place where you can insert a business card so you can identify your bag. It's kind of a neat way to easily recognize your bag if you're amongst a bunch of other photographers. It's got two side zipper pockets. I have a spare strap in here that I got from Smug Mug inside one. It's got some mesh in there, so it's a little stretchable. You could easily fit a water bottle on one of these side pockets, and it's got two of those also with that same mesh type holder for it. What most impressed me about this Think Tank photo bag was the padding on the backside. It's got a lot more padding than the Low Pro Street Trekker did. Made it much more comfortable on my back. I carried it with me over the holidays to see how the weight would feel of all the gear on my back, and it really felt nice. So I really enjoyed the back padding and the shoulder strap padding. It's very thick there and very comfortable for the back. I like that they added more padding there, so that's definitely a plus in their favor. One thing I didn't like about the bag, though, was their interior padding. Their interior padding panels, little Velcro panels that you can take in and out and position how you want inside the bag, were kind of thin. Compared to the foam panels that were in the Low Pro, they were probably easily half the thickness of the Low Pro ones. So I was a little surprised at, I shouldn't say skimpy, because they aren't skimpy. They're clearly good quality, but they don't have the same degree of padding that the Low Pro did for the interior panels. I thought, given the exterior padding that they did for your back, they would also provide that same measure of padding for the inside. And I think the reason why they actually did that was to maximize interior space. Like I said, on my Low Pro, I couldn't hold everything in there. With the Think Tank, I can hold everything in there. With one little other caveat, it is full to the gills, so if I were to purchase anything else, I would need to get another bag. If I got one more, even a small lens, it wouldn't fit in this bag. It's really packed full. The 40D is a tight fit towards the front. The body of the 40D, I've got a quick-release plate that's not permanently attached, but I keep it on there all the time. That made it kind of heavy or kind of thick to the comparative to the bag, so it made it somewhat snug in closing. I don't know if that's by design or if they intended us to put the camera body towards the foot end of the bag. I like having mine towards the top, so when I take it off, when I first open the bag, the camera's right there. So that is a downside to it, is that the 40D seemed kind of snug on it. On the upside, though, I really like the look of the bag itself. It's that typical black, but it's got navy blue, or royal blue, actually, I should say, little pinstripes down the side, both on the padding and on the shoulder pads. And the zippers also have that color to them. And then there's stitching, very high-quality stitching on the interior pockets and the accessory pockets that really just shows the quality of workmanship that's gone into it. So it, overall, it's a really great bag. If I had to weigh the bag, it would probably come in at maybe 3 or 4 pounds. I know they probably have tech specs on their site about that, so I'd encourage you to go there, check those out. The last thing that I like about it is the handle on the top of the bag. The handle actually goes the entire width of the bag. And because it goes the entire width with a little bit of play, you can grab that handle and you're not going to have to squeeze your fingers to get underneath there. Like I said, I'm 6'1", so I'm kind of tall. My hands are a little on the bigger side, and my hand fits comfortably in there so that I can get my fingers around that, even if I was wearing gloves in a cold environment. So it's a very good quality bag. They have no doubt put a lot of thought and development into the research of the bag. But I think I am probably not going to be interested in this specific model of the Streetwalker, primarily because, like I said, my gear that I would want to take with me is pretty much going to stuff this thing full to the hilt. I'd like to have a little more room for expansion. That's not necessarily a bag limitation, though. That's just a personal limitation. I'd like to have some more space. So I would actually be looking at probably the next grade up of the Streetwalker series. The way I understand it, there is also a detachable belt that you can put on the bottom of this, and I see where you can do that because there's two little loops down the bottom where you can loop another accessory component on. It's basically like a fanny pack, I think, and that I'd be really interested in having a look at that, because that way I could put my my body and maybe a lens or two in there while reserving the backpack for things like my laptop, which currently I couldn't fit in there at all because my gear does take up all the space. So it's a pretty good bag system. I would recommend it for someone that has a minimalist gear approach, because it won't hold a lot of gear, but it will hold enough gear. So if you just want a zoom lens, a macro lens, and a wide-angle lens, you can get away with this bag and have enough flexibility to carry everything you could need out on a streetwalking shoot with you and not have yourself stand out like a sore thumb. The other thing, the last thing I did want to note about this bag is that you got a lot of dividers to put inside the bag, so you can pretty much customize the interior configuration any way you want. I thought that was kind of cool, because with the Low Pro, I only got like 3 or 4. So I was a little disappointed in how much I could move things around and what I could do versus the Think Tank Photo. They gave you more than enough. I think there were 10 total dividers. I can actually count them up and give you an accurate count there. So I got 3 sitting outside the bag right now. And then inside the bag, there's another 3 inside there, so 6, and then the center divider makes 7. So there's actually not 10, but a lot more than the three or four that I got from the Low Pro. So that is one other kind of a big caveat, I guess. The big thing for me is being able to put the tripod on the outside of the bag on the back rather than on the bottom, because when you put the tripod on the bottom, that can uncomfortably hit against your butt or your back if it's riding low on you or riding high on you, depending on your size. And that can get uncomfortable. That's how the Low Pro did it. From the Think Tank, it is stored vertically, and the quick-release straps can make it easy to get on and off. On the Low Pro, it was a little more challenging. You had to go through a few more hoops to do that. So I want to thank Think Tank for generously giving me this bag to review. It actually reviews pretty well. If I had to give it a grade on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being the best, I would probably give it a 3.7, maybe 3.8. There are some limitations to it, so that's probably why it doesn't get a higher grade on my book. But overall, it's a very good bag. You can tell there's been a lot of thought put into it, and it certainly is a sturdy enough product. Oh, one other thing that's nice about this bag is they also gave you a rain cover. So if you get caught in a downpour, there's a collapsible rain cover. You pull that out, stretch it out over the bag, and it covers everything and keeps all your expensive, valuable gear away from out of harm's way, away from the elements, if you ever needed that. That was a very nice feature on there. I really like the mesh of the back on the bag, too. It's very professional, but it doesn't scream, "Steal me," like many camera bags do. So kudos to Think Tank for putting a lot of quality and thought and care into the design of the bag. Closing thoughts, it is kind of squarish. It's got a squared off look rather than a rounded look. So it's a unique look for camera bags. I've got two other backpack type camera bags. Like I said, the Lowepro Street Trekker, which is what I'm using for my main basis of comparison. Then I've also got a Victronics one. Pardon me. I've also got a Victronics one that has two side pockets that can fit water bottles, and it can also accommodate a laptop. That's primarily why I got that, was as a laptop bag. And then I've also got a belt and harness system from Think Tank, not from Think Tank, I'm sorry, from Lowepro, that I've used on various photo shoots, especially when I'm doing nature walks and hiking, things of that nature. I think probably this would be a good complement bag, this backpack, to a belt and harness system. So if you're out on a long expedition where you have the intention of taking lots of photos, this could make a good part of a larger series. So I really would like to see how this works in conjunction with something like that, with a belt system. If I do go on a dedicated photo trip, that's probably what I would do, is I would use this Street Trekker in conjunction with belt and harness, and take things from that approach, especially if you don't have a whole bunch of gear. If you started to have more gear than three or four lenses and more than one body, you would want to have a bigger bag, because this bag simply couldn't accommodate it. Overall, though, a 3.7, 3.8. Good job, Think Tank Photo. Thank you so much for generously donating that for review purposes. And don't forget to stay tuned to the end of the podcast to see how you can win this bag. Welcome back to CanonBlogger.com. You're listening to the second segment in episode number 64 for the Canon Blogger podcast series. In this segment, I'm going to be taking a look at the value of the backstory. And the value of the backstory is something that came to me from reading participating in a forum that used to be called the Radiant Vista. This featured Mark Johnson as one of their photographers. Craig Tanner is also one of the photographers over there. It's a very useful forum community, and I know they rebranded recently. I don't remember their rebranded name off the top of my head, but if you Google Radiant Vista, it will still take you to their website, so I would encourage you to do that. One of the things that I found really enjoyable was listening to Craig Tanner's podcasts, where he would talk about the backstory for his images or for some of his experiences. And he did that as a springboard for creativity rituals, creative journaling, things of that nature. And it just really gave good insight to how he is wired as a photographer, what works for him, what doesn't work for him. And he really is effective as a communicator by relating his own stories to the audience. And that really gave me the idea, actually, of inserting the backstory concept over here at Canon Blogger, because I've realized more and more that photography is often very much a personal thing, and it's very difficult to communicate the personal emotions that you get from capturing a particular photo or the emotions that surround an event in a photo and getting that to communicate through just the photo itself. Now, sure, the best photos out there will do that. They don't need any supportive elements, whether it's a narration or an anecdote or music or anything like that. Truly, the best photos will stand on their own. And having said that, I really don't want to encourage anyone to think that they can mitigate poor quality of photography with simply providing a backstory, because that obviously is not going to work. What I'm saying here is that by adding the backstory or the surrounding elements to whether it's an anecdote or a narrative or anything like that, it can enhance a good photo even more. And case in point is a blog entry post that I made just the other day called The Boneyard and the Backstory. And it actually was a pretty good image. I don't think it's probably going to win any awards or anything like that because it's not perfectly composed. There's a couple flaws with it. But in knowing the backstory, it really helped elevate the experience that I had in capturing that photo. And I'm going to share that with you in a little more detail here today than I did over on the blog. Basically, let me set this up a little bit. The Boneyard is actually an area of a beach on an island called Bull Island, and that's off the coast of South Carolina. And Bull Island is an uninhabited island by humans. There's wildlife there. There's actually quite a large alligator that lives on that island. And what had happened was many, many, many years ago, probably hundreds of years ago, there was a rainforest of trees or a set of trees that lined the shoreline of that island. And over time, the salt water and the sun and the erosion from all this, the trees died so that nothing is left but the bark that's basically like petrified. It's like a petrified forest. It's pretty hard wood there. It's not going to get broken up. But because of the sun and the sand and the salt and everything, they've all been bleached white so that they look like bones. It can make for some very compelling imagery. And it's a place that many people go just to experience, and photographers often go to take pictures of. And what's interesting about it is that there is one boat company out there that provides tours out to Bull Island. So they give tours out, and they have regularly scheduled tours in the peak season. I think they give 3 tours a day and or 5 tours a day. And then in the off season, they give 3 tours a day. They cut down the schedule, and their tours start, I think the first boat usually leaves at like 8 or 9 in the morning. So you get, and it takes about an hour to get a whole cattle car full of people out there. So they get out to the island around 9 or 10, and you can only arrive at the dock is only on the west side of the island, and Boneyard Beach is on the east end of the island. So you pretty much have to trek the whole island, which is about 2 miles, maybe 3 miles over to the beach. So it's not a huge trek, but you are walking over sand, and they have some paths, and it's kind of a circuitous route. So if you're not up for a good walking tour, it's probably not going to be the best place for you. And that's a little caveat for anyone that lives over in that area. Our photo group, I was in a photo group out in South Carolina called the South Carolina Photography Guild. I was one of the founding members of this group. It still exists, so for those of you that may be interested, you can find the site over at scphotogs.com. I still administer the forums for them happily and freely. But our group had taken a trip out there, I think, 2 years ago, 3 years ago now. We're in 2009. So in 2006, we went out as a group on one of their regularly scheduled tours, so there were other people that were on the boat as well. And the day we got there, and it was $30 a head. And the day that we got there, it was kind of overcast. The wildlife wasn't really in season. It was just basically walking around a barren island. We were all carrying a lot of photo gear, so we were all getting kind of tired and hot and thirsty. We didn't really pack appropriately for Bull Island. We didn't know a lot about it. It was our first trip there. So we kind of scouted it out. We kind of chalked it off as a scouting trip, and we're walking around and sharing our own thoughts and stories and whatnot of our gear that we currently had, the gear we were looking for. It was basically a get-together at that point rather than a photo shoot. And it was a lot of fun in that regard. But from scouting it, we knew kind of what we wanted to do for the next time, and that was to see if we could make it out there for a sunrise or somewhere near sunrise. So in doing some more research and in talking with the people that ran the boat ferry, we asked them if we could get a private charter to go out there. And they said, sure, you know, we can run a private charter for you out there when we're looking to go if these times don't work. And we said, well, we'd like to go out there at sunrise, you know, possibly catch some sunrise shots on down on the beach by the boneyard, or, you know, just get some better quality of light overall, you know, as we're touring the island. And they kind of grimaced a little bit and said, well, we don't really normally go out that early. It's going to cost you a lot more. So we ended up saying, well, if we can get 10 people, how much would it cost? And they said, well, a boat trip runs $300 for us to break even. So we can get you out there and back for $300. So actually that trip with the 10 of us was 30. So I think their day trips were only 25 per person, or 20 per person or something like that. So that's how they got their profit, was by getting more people than 10 on each ferry trip. And we offered to get them to their break-even point so they wouldn't spend any money. We got 10 people to go, and the cost per person then was $30. And because of the scheduling of the trip, we didn't really want to get started way too early. But by the same token, we did want that good light. So we said, let's start our trip a little before sunrise. Let's get there at 6 a.m., get to the docking ferry so we can get to the island by 7. And then we can take half an hour to walk across the island, get there at 7:30, which is right about sunrise time. Well, what ended up happening is one of the participants in the expedition was running late, thought we were meeting at a different location, so she was delayed by about 30 minutes in getting to the ferry, and the group had elected to wait for her. So while waiting for her, time was ticking away, of course. The clock was our enemy now. And as another little caveat, which you know about on the blog, if you read the blog post, is that I had recommended to the group to rent some bikes. You can rent bikes for $15 to $20 from a local biking company that you can use to tour the areas and you can take around the beaches and whatnot. And I thought that might be a perfect way to actually get more coverage of the island in the time we had allotted. So I did make that recommendation. I guess from the cost per head of getting over to the island, no one really wanted to get a bike in addition to that. So I was the only one that ended up taking a bike out. So with 10 of us setting off, we got about a half an hour late start. There were 10 of us. Each of us had all our own camera gear, which I'll say was probably worth about $2,000 to $3,000 a piece. So with 10 of us, it's $20,000 to $30,000. I had a bike in this skiff, and we were taking the smaller boat. So we were pretty loaded down and low in the water. And this guy started putting us out there with an outboard motor. And about halfway out, and it's pretty dark still. It's dark and it's cold. We're all bundled up, you know, very cold at this time of day. And about halfway out there, the guy just cuts the motor off. And we said, okay, why'd you cut off the motor? And he goes, shh, hang on. And we're like, what's going on? And then this guy stands up. And one thing I always learned was never stand up in a boat. So when this guy stood up, I started getting a little nervous. And he's looking around. He's looking left. He's looking right. He's looking for something. And in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, he's either lost or he's looking for his contact that's going to come out and steal all our camera gear. And since it probably wasn't the latter, I thought he was probably lost, and it was. He was, and he kind of muttered as he was sitting back down, you know, don't like going out this early, can't find my landmarks. But he got back on the right track, and we got on our way, and we found the island, and we docked out. So by now, instead of it being 7 o'clock, it's pretty close to 7:30. It's probably about 7:20, and it's getting lighter and lighter and lighter with every walking step. So at this point, I'm faced with a decision, and I said, well, what do I do? Do I stay with the group and just make it another group outing, or do I hop on my bike and take off and kind of leave and blow them off? Well, because I really had already scouted and I knew what I wanted to do on that particular shoot, and I had a picture in my mind of what I wanted to capture, I said, you know what? I put 50, 60 bucks into this, and as a beginning photographer, that was a pretty big expense. So I said, you know what? I'm going after the shot. So I bid them goodbye, I hopped on my bike, and I made a beeline for the beach. Now, on Bull Island, they have rules about where you can and cannot ride your bikes. And they do not want you to ride your bikes on the beach. You can ride your bikes on the trails, but not on the beach. They don't want them disrupted. So I said, all right, I won't ride on the beach. And I got out to the buffer sand area between the beach and the walking paths, and I had to ditch my bike. So I didn't even see the beach yet, and I assumed I was getting out at the right location. So I ditched the bike, and I trot across the 10 to 20 yards of sand and get to the beach just as the sun is cresting on the horizon. And on the beach, of course, I am not at the boneyard. The boneyard was easily another 100 yards down the beach on me. So with camera gear in hand, I trot down the beach as quickly as I can because I'm kind of winded by now. And I get down there and I look around and I see all the bones on the beach, all the tree trunks that are all bleached. They're still kind of black looking because it's still kind of dark out. And the sun is rising rapidly. And we've got some gorgeous colors in the sky, some reds, some oranges, some blues. There's some clouds. And as I'm trotting down there, I see a possible spot where the sun could be rising between two of the bigger branches of two of these stumped trees. So I said, well, maybe I can get there in time. So I made a beeline for that spot. Got there, set up my tripod, set up the camera, guessed at the exposure. I didn't even think about metering back then. I didn't know what metering was. I didn't really know much of the craft yet. So just guessed at the numbers. And I think I set it up as an F-22 or something like that, F-22 at 1/40th of a second with an ISO of 800 or an ISO 400 or something like that on a Canon XT. And I got the frame that I shared at the end of that blog post the other day. I got that frame off and about four or five other frames off, knowing that this is probably going to be the last time I would ever have to get out there at this time, just because it was so cost prohibitive. And at that point I thought I got a couple decent photos that were worth working up in post, and was there for about half an hour, 20 minutes to a half an hour, when the rest of the photo group shows up. I'm like, hey, we saw your bike, didn't know what happened to you, came out to the beach, saw you down here taking pictures, so thought we'd come on down. And they all looked at me inquisitively and said, did you get any pictures? And I looked back at them and I just smiled. And of course I answered yes. You know, I think I might have gotten a few ones. I think I might have gotten here in time. I won't know for sure until I get back on the mainland and go through post and see what came out of the camera. And you'll see at the end of the blog post that, yeah, a couple did work out. But that's the backstory of the Boneyard Beach in South Carolina. I understand there's another island very similar to this over in Georgia called Jekyll Island. And it's really eerie how similar they are, except for the differences in the color of the bones or the downed tree trunks, because the shots I'd seen from Jekyll Island that someone had shared with me, the trees were much browner. It's like they weren't bleached completely white yet. But I'm guessing they were probably part of the same ecosystem, because if I understand the geography right, they were in the same area of the Atlantic, so it just makes sense that you would have similar instances. I do want to thank Mike Palmer of Mike Palmer's blog, Mike Palmer Photography. He's got a blog out there. He had shared with me some images that he'd taken over on Jekyll Island, which were very similar in nature. But what made this really special for me was the fact that there probably aren't a lot of these particular shots in existence. As far as I know, boats don't go out at sunrise. They haven't. I don't know if they are doing anything since. But it's kind of a neat backstory, and it gives you a unique character to what went into capturing these images. And it just goes to show you that the backstory can have some meaning in your photos. So I would encourage you to stop over to the blog, take a look at the picture. I'll go ahead and post the link back to the Boneyard and the backstory post so you can look at the picture there. And I would also encourage you to share your own experiences and photos with me. Throw links up in the blog if the images are sized 425 pixels wide at the widest. I can put together montages and put those in the blog as well. So that's the value of the backstory. If you'll stay tuned after the break, I'm going to go over some blog notes, which includes how you can win that Think Tank photo bag. So make sure you stick around because you're going to want to hear about how to do that. Hello and welcome back to CanonBlogger.com. I know I said I was going to go over some blog and podcast administrative housekeeping type things here in this segment. And the first thing I wanted to note is that the sidebar has been cleaned up quite a bit. I had some people asking about what happened to the polls, what happened to the feed burner link, what happened to this, what happened to that. I cleaned it up quite a bit for two reasons. One, it was starting to look a little cluttered to me and I wanted to move back towards a minimalist approach to how things are presented on the blog. And secondly, I know some things are coming up down the road as we move the blog towards a hosted solution with Personal Life Media, and I wanted to clean things up in preparation for some content I know will be going up on the sidebar in the future there. So that's the housekeeping side of things there. If anyone does have things they'd like to see on the sidebar or news, whether it's news or information or things of that nature, please feel free to drop a line to me, jason@canonblogger.com, or you can share your ideas, things of that nature, in the comment section of the blog as well. The other thing that you're obviously tuning in for now is to hear how to win that Think Tank Photo Streetwalker bag that I had been reviewing. And since I'm encouraging people to participate on the blog, from the first 20 people that provide useful feedback or commentary on blog posts, and when I say useful, I mean useful. Don't just pop in and say, hi, I love the blog, thanks. Hey, I'm over here too. Hey, don't forget about me. I'm actually talking about useful commentary. The first 20 people that post will be, your names will be put into a hat, and I will pick one person at random to send the Think Tank Photo Streetwalker bag to. So if you're interested in winning a Think Tank Photo bag, it's the Streetwalker, the basic Streetwalker bag, please feel free to stop in and share some thoughts in the comments section. Like I said, I'll take one person's name at random, put everything into an Excel spreadsheet, and have it pick one at random, or draw a name from a hat, something like that, so that nothing is geared towards favoritism or anything of that nature. So feel free to stop over to the blog. The blog site address, for those of you that don't know, is www.canonblogger.com. So I'm looking forward to hearing what comments and ideas people have by throwing this bag out there as a prize of sorts. So coming back right after this, we'll wrap up with the listener questions and the photo tip of the week. Thanks, and we'll be right back. Back to the final segment for CanonBlogger.com. I'm going to take a couple listener questions here. The first comes from Christy in Arizona. She writes in asking about high-capacity memory cards versus lower-capacity cards. In light of some recent news that hit the photography industry, or hit the technology industry, I should say, is the format has been proposed for SDXC, Secure Digital Extended Capacity cards. These are cards, the proposed cards anyway, will have up to 2 terabytes of storage available to them. That obviously won't be in stores or available to consumers for probably another year or so. But in looking at the XC format versus the HC format, which is high capacity, and then your standard capacity cards, it really is a matter of personal preference, shooting style, what kind of cameras you own. If you own a camera that has a higher megapixel count, naturally, you're going to get fewer images per card than you would otherwise. If you're using a higher megapixel camera, it's also going to depend on what types of things you shoot. If you go out and you're capturing a wedding ceremony or other type of event, you're probably going to take more pictures than someone that shoots landscapes, for example. So if you have the need to store lots of images in as tight a space as you can, then obviously HC formatted cards would suit your needs more effectively. The larger picture that I want to paint here, though, is to keep in mind that you never want to put all your images on one card. You don't want to quote-unquote, put all your eggs in one basket. If you lose a card, or if a card becomes corrupted, or if any one of a number of catastrophes happens where you don't have that card anymore, it's always beneficial to have multiple cards. And if it were up to me, I would rather have four gigabyte cards versus one 16 gigabyte card, or a 32 gigabyte card if you're talking about high capacity, or even going into that XC, that extended capacity where you can store 2 terabytes of data. For me, something like that, I would really only see a need for it if you're shooting video, or if you've got audio recordings that you're doing on the fly out in the field, as opposed to being at a computer. And then, of course, the other option for those XC-type cards would be if you have a laptop in the future that's being developed with solid-state memory. That could be a very useful implementation there as well. But for me, I like to shoot more lower-capacity cards than on fewer high-capacity cards just because of that. So that is the perspective I will hold. If anyone would like to discuss that or has other views on that, please feel free to share them in the comments section over on the blog. Thank you, Christy, for the email. I appreciate it very much. The other question comes to us from Clay right here in Colorado. Clay writes in asking about different backup strategies. He basically is asking what the best backup strategy is. And I really don't like, it's a good question, but I really don't like it when people say, should I do A or B? Because that means that it's an either-or option, and there's always going to be different aspects to consider, regardless of whatever decision you're making, whether it's what camera to buy, Canon or Nikon, or Olympus or Sony or Pentax, what kind of car to buy, Ford or Chevy or whoever. I don't really see things in A versus B terms. I don't like to draw a finite line in the sand. It really depends on what you're storing and what kind of redundancy, what kind of tolerance you have, what kind of risk you have, and how important your data is to you. But to paint a broad scheme over it, I basically see three or four different types, three main stream types of backup strategies. One using media, and by that I mean CDs, DVDs. I guess you could also include tape drives in that category as well, but I kind of see tape drives as off on their own because not a lot of people use them, primarily because they are rather expensive and difficult to implement unless you really know what you're doing. But CDs and DVDs are great for temporary things, whether it be Word documents or snapshot-type photos, things of that nature. That doesn't really classify as archival backup or anything like that, just because it's not as reliable. DVDs can get scratched, they can get snapped in half, they can get easily damaged to where you can't access your data. Same thing holds for DVDs, whether it's single, dual layer, or Blu-ray. They really don't have a permanence to them, or have very much permanence to them. I would much prefer hard drives, whether it's a portable drive or a drive inside your computer, or a drive as part of a storage area network like a Drobo or a RAID setup or something like that. Not only are you going to have much more capacity for storing things and your archivability is going to be there, you're also going to have more redundancy, and it's going to be easier to move forward. If you store things on media versus hard drives, you're going to find it much more difficult to port data from one source to another. So those are the two biggies, the media and then the hard drives. And then there is a third option, the cloud or the internet, where you can upload your files to the internet and have them safely stored there and accessible from anywhere. And that is a big pro for that, having your data accessible from any location. I wouldn't recommend using that as a primary means of archiving all your data just because it can get expensive. I know most hosting providers will give you a certain amount free with a hosting account if you have a website or a blog or something like that. But beyond that, it can get pretty expensive. I've got a 250 gigabyte hard drive here as a Western Digital backup. If I were to store that much on the cloud, that would cost me more than $100 a month. And it was a one-time cost for me to buy this, my book, hard drive to store that much. And actually, I think I just got a 500 gig upgrade. So it's even cheaper now. And with storage being so cheap, I don't really see the cloud as an option for storing all your data. Maybe a select few, a couple dozen, maybe a couple hundred photos, but definitely not everything you have. I don't think that's really a cost-effective means. And then the other aspect of that is also, if you're going to be storing that much data in the cloud, it can take a long time. If you've got more than a couple hundred megabytes of data, it can take up to an hour or even more. If you have gigabytes and gigabytes of data online, it can take you overnight just to get everything down, or to get everything up for that matter. So the upload-download accessibility is a factor that's probably decreasingly a factor anymore with the nature of high-speed trends. I've seen 16-megabyte download speeds, 6-megabyte upload speeds through Etherloop scenarios, so that is becoming less of a factor, but it still, for the time being, is a factor. But those are the three questions, or excuse me, the two questions that I received for this week's podcast. I'd like to thank Christy and Clay for writing in. I don't have a tip for the week. I've been pretty busy wrapping up with a previous job, and I'm starting a new job next week with the government, so that's pretty exciting times. I did want to say thank you to all the listeners as we continue to move forward with the rebranding process of getting a bio page set up and getting a profile page set up and getting a new blog description page set up and branding the blog with Personal Life Media. It's a lot of groundwork, a lot of foundations being built that we've been putting some time into. We should have an announcement coming up in another week or two here as we finalize all the details. And it's going to be pretty exciting. We're going to have interviews. We're going to have contests. We're going to have more product reviews, things of that nature. So it's going to be a pretty exciting time as we move forward from here. I want to thank everyone for their patience, especially Personal Life Media for taking on Canon Bloggers Podcast. We're tossing around a couple show title ideas right now. So like I said, it's pretty exciting. But that is pretty much it for this week. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we will see you next week. Have a good one, and happy shooting. Bye.